as I say, I ultimately accepted the offer to go to the University of Nebraska as graduate dean. I suppose in part, it was certainly not that I was unhappy with or disenchanted with life at Kansas. But I had come to the completion of one major, the crossing of one major mountain range in bringing the BA degree into the curriculum at Kansas State, and really setting the College of Liberal Arts in a position to be just as important, just as influential, just as much the center of that university as agriculture and engineering. And this was sort of, in a way, a major first accomplishment there, and that had just been completed. And so it didn't, maybe it was in a way a simply a feeling of, well, maybe maybe you won the first big one here, why not take on a different kind of an assignment. I still wasn't completely sure that I wanted to stay in administration. I was enjoying it, and I seemed to be getting along well, but I just here was an opportunity to experiment with still a different kind of administration. And my background from Wisconsin, the days of Slichter and E.B. Fred and others, had always sort of demonstrated, you know, the fact that an awful lot of the most important administrative activity in a great university came from the work that was done with faculty leadership in that graduate school deanship. And I guess I somehow was conditioned to the belief that the graduate dean was a pretty rewarding administrative job if you were going to be in administration. And so here was my first chance at being one, and here was a chance of being one in an AAU university, and therefore in contact with the graduate deans of all the best graduate schools of the country. And so I went. And one of the very interesting first things that happened to me in that regard was that Florence Anderson, who was then secretary of the Carnegie Corporation in New York, which position she held until just a year or so ago, had a little fellowship program, an informal sort of a little arrangement that they had for what they regarded as promising young administrators in the American educational scene, who could profit by being supported for anywhere from 3 to 6 months of travel and study among other universities, or in whatever way the person involved wanted to set it up, to investigate the backgrounds of effective service in the kind of administration they were going into. And here I was coming up over the horizon as a new graduate dean, and Florence Anderson called me up one day in Manhattan in the spring of my last year there, and she said, "We hear you're going to Nebraska as graduate dean," and she said, "I wonder if maybe you'd be interested in one of these little traveling fellowships we have to go see other graduate schools and get a little feel for what's going on in graduate education these days."
Oh, sounds like a dandy idea.
That's what I told her. And I said, "Well, that's just delightful. I'd be delighted to do that." So I went to we moved to Nebraska in July. I guess it was in September I took off on the first of two trips, each about a month and a half in duration. And I went west on the first trip. I went to the universities of UCLA, Stanford, Berkeley, Oregon, Washington, University of British Columbia. Oh, and I stopped at the University of Utah. I talked to the graduate deans, the presidents, faculty leadership about the perceptions of the day and about the role of the graduate dean, about the role of the federal government in the support of research, which was just then becoming really significant. The whole gamut of the determination of membership on of graduate faculties and many associated subjects. Met a lot of people who, over the years after that, presidents of other institutions and graduate deans from other institutions that both had an important part in my life, as well as my relationship with them led to important developments in the field of graduate education. I went back to Lincoln about Christmas time, and or just before Christmas time, and I had and worked at my job for two or three more months, and then in the spring, I took another junket on that Carnegie Fellowship. At that time, it took me south and east. I went to Texas at Austin, Rice University, or Rice Institute then at Houston, Tulane, North Carolina, went to the University of Toronto, to McGill, Princeton, Harvard. I may have missed one or two, but I guess I went to Michigan.
That's a pretty good list.
And that also was a very interesting series of experiences. There are so many people that I met for the first time on those trips who have subsequently been among the real leaders of American higher education, and people who have been close personal friends over all the years since those Carnegie trips that I made. I got involved in national graduate education affairs very heavily in my years at Nebraska. I became one of the first members of the first National Defense Education Act Graduate Fellowship Program Committee in Washington, in which we formulated many of the earliest kinds of federal attitudes toward graduate education and the support of graduate education from the federal level. I became a member of the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship Board. I became very active in the affairs of the Association of Graduate Schools, the graduate school part of the AAU, which I ultimately became the president. And it was out of my associations while still at Nebraska that we organized the Association of Graduate Schools, which is the Council of Graduate Schools, which is now the principal national organization of graduate schools across the country, not just AAU graduate schools, but graduate schools of many kinds of institutions.
I see.
And I was the first president of that Council of Graduate Schools. Actually, that Council of Graduate Schools, which is now the real center of graduate education affairs for the nation, really came into being in my conference room in the graduate school offices at Lincoln, Nebraska, together with some confreres that were interested in helping develop such an organization, who worked with me there, Robert Lemyansky, who was then the dean of the graduate school at Tulane, now president of the American Council of Learned Societies, Peter Elder, who was the graduate dean at Harvard, who came out to Lincoln to join us in that business of putting the Council of Graduate Schools together with a constitution and all the rest. A third member of that group who met with me in Lincoln to give birth to the Council of Graduate Schools was Alexander Hurd, who was then the graduate dean at the University of North Carolina and has the last 12, 14 years been chancellor of the Vanderbilt University. And a man by the name of, improbable name of Joe McCarthy, who was then the graduate dean at the University of Washington in Seattle. All of us were very active in the affairs of the Association of Graduate Schools within the AAU. We all felt that there had to be a national graduate school organization that was broader than the membership of the AAU, which was the reason for this. And this was ultimately brought into being, first of all, by sort of the godfather and the midwife of the Council of Graduate Schools, really was the Association of Graduate Schools within the AAU that recognized that there needed to be a much broader national organization than just the AAU. And as I say, I served as the first president of the Council of Graduate Schools. Ultimately, we hired as the first organizational head of that group, a full-time person to be resident in Washington, and the name of Gustav Arlt, A-R-L-T, who I had met when I was out on my Carnegie trip as he was then dean of the graduate school at UCLA. And Gustav Arlt served about the first 10, 12 years as the first head of the Council of Graduate Schools, the first staff head of the Council of Graduate Schools. So that my years in Nebraska were ones that had a good many interesting experiences on the home grounds in Nebraska and at the University of Nebraska, which is a very interesting institution with a lot of very fine academic traditions. But it also was for me a very active period in my life in national educational affairs.
That sounds it.
And during that period, I came to know a lot of university administrative personnel from one end of the country to the other, both public and private university type people. And it was in those years that I was at Nebraska that I got my first enticements to move on to the presidency of some institutions. While I was at Nebraska, I was offered the presidency of the University of Hawaii, a position I turned down mostly because I didn't really hanker for that kind of isolation, geographic isolation. And it was much more isolated then than with the jet travel of today.
Yes.
I was very seriously considered for the presidency at Tulane at the inside urgings of my friend Lemyansky, who really should have been president of Tulane himself, but for the unfortunate reason that he was Jewish, he was unacceptable for president of the university in that New Orleans setting, and that kind of soured my view of things in New Orleans, even as I looked at the job. But then, as a result of some of the work I had done from with Carnegie through and the leadership I had been able to contribute to in the building of National Graduate Affairs, I had on two occasions had occasion to speak to the presidents of the AAU, who met once a year with the deans of the graduate schools in the AAU. And I had served as spokesman for the deans of the graduate schools twice in speaking to the presidents of the AAU, and had gotten acquainted with many of those AAU presidents, in fact with most of them. And one of them, Virgil Hancher, who had been the longtime president of the University of Iowa, had apparently been particularly impressed with some of the things that I had said in some of those discussions. And one day Virgil called me up and said, we're looking for a new graduate dean over here at Iowa, and we want the graduate dean also to be carry the title of vice president for research for the university. And he says, as a matter of fact, our academic vice president here is close to retirement, and he said, I'm sort of looking for a graduate dean and vice president for research who will sort of work into being my academic number two man, or my number two man in for academic affairs for the university. Well, I had a very successful, very happy time at Lincoln. Ms. Weaver and I greatly enjoyed Lincoln as a place to live. Lincoln is very much like Madison. It's about the same size. It's the state capital and it's the university. And Lincoln has many, it's sort of Madison without lakes. It's a very much of the same kind of a flavor of a town. And we felt very much at home in Lincoln, and we developed many fine and enduring friendships there. And as you can see, as I look back over my career, I've enjoyed it wherever I've been. I think Ms. Weaver and I have had the capacity for enjoying life where we found it. And I really think back over our 4 years at Lincoln as having been very rewarding ones. But Virgil seemed to be holding out a kind of a new level of opportunity to me, and I'd grown up in the Big Ten, and the thought of going back to the Big Ten had some appeal. And so with some reluctance, but also with a feeling of new challenge, we went to Iowa City. And the 3 years we spent there were very busy ones. They were ones in which I got into very actively continued in National Graduate Affairs, but I also became very much involved in Big Ten affairs. The CIC, the Committee on Institutional Cooperation that ties the Big Ten universities together to do something together other than football, tries to prove that we can do things together academically too. There's a very exciting kind of new set of visions in what you can do in inter-institutional academic affairs, and I became, after a couple of years, the chairman of that group. I'm the only person that served on the CIC from two different universities, and both from Iowa and from Ohio State, and I was its chairman for 4 years, two from each of those universities. And I this brought me back into the group of universities with which I was more familiar from tradition and from background. And I think we had some good years at Iowa. Actually, just as a footnote to history, Mr. Hancher, who in my 3 years at Iowa was concluding the 22 years that he had spent as president of the University of Iowa, had, and I don't know that this was ever very widely known, but it was increasingly clear that Virgil hoped to see me succeed him as president of the University of Iowa. This surfaced very clearly at one point when, while I was at Iowa, I had the presidency of the University of Colorado dangled in my face, and because I had always had a standing love affair with the Rocky Mountains and had spent many vacations and happy family times in Colorado, I was sort of attracted by Boulder because of this as a place to live, if nothing else. And Virgil made it very clear to me at that point, when he knew that Colorado was after me, that he said, I wish you'd hang on here for another year or two, because he said, I very much hope you will succeed me as president of the University of Iowa. And well, I did stay at Iowa. And then, in his final year, as fate sometimes works out, his last 18 months, as his known retirement was coming down the pike, Hancher's relationship with two or three of the very influential members of the Board of Regents in Iowa deteriorated. And one of the members of that Board of Regents just made up her mind that, by George, whoever Virgil Hancher wanted to be his successor as president damn well wasn't going to be. Because she just was not going to let anyone become president of that university who was picked by Hancher to succeed himself. Actually, my relations with the Board of Regents members individually at Iowa was very good, but and I saw them a great deal. I went to all the regent meetings as vice president and graduate dean, and but because the president became known to have sort of chosen me as the man he wanted to succeed him, and the fact that he got in some trouble with leadership in the Iowa board near the end of his tenure there resulted in the fact that it began to increasingly to appear to me that I was going to be the center of some controversy within the Iowa board. even though I don't think any of them had anything against me personally. It was just the crossfire that somehow develops sometimes in people's lives that really doesn't relate to you so much personally as it just catches you up in its own coils. And so it really was for that reason that when Navis Fawcett, the president at Ohio State, and I had also come to know, like I had many of the AAU university presidents in the and Big Ten presidents in my various work in the CIC and in the graduate school groups and so on. Nav Fawcett called me up one day and he said, John, he said, we need a new academic vice president and dean of faculties for the Ohio State University, my number two man. And he said, this is a big opportunity. And he said, I understand that Virgil Hancher hopes that you're going to succeed him as president at the University of Iowa, but he said, if anything happens to that relationship, I just would like you to know I'd like you to come to Columbus. Well, I said, Nav, that's right nice of you. I said, I feel as though I've moved almost enough, and I said, it's nice to know somebody wants me in case it does get a little tight around here, and I said, I'll certainly keep that in mind. Is it all right if I call you any time in the next few months? That's all right, he said. I said, I'd wait for you for a long time.
Were you already suspecting that things were not going
well? I knew that
totally to your liking.
There was some of this problem developing between Hancher and some of the top regents of Iowa. And I didn't know quite where it was leading. But I began to sense I might get caught up in it, and I wasn't just sure how it was going to work out. And so, following one regent meeting at the University of Iowa, where it suddenly became quite clear to me that I was going to become a center of a controversy that really was not of my doing, I just decided, well, by George, I'm just not going to get mixed up in that kind of a situation. And
it didn't speak too well for your future there, did it?
No, I didn't think so. And I, nobody would have tried to get me to resign or would have wanted me to resign, but I think simply because some people would have perceived me as being Hancher's own hand-picked successor, weren't going to let that happen, and then I'd be in a kind of a strange situation. There were a lot of people at the University of Iowa that were working real hard to, including the search and screen committee that already had come into being, looking for a new president. The chairman of that committee, who was the dean of the law school at Iowa, talked to me many times about it. He said, you're the man we want to be president of this university, and just sit tight. This is all going to work out all right. But I finally decided there was too much room in that for personal difficulties, and especially when it involved regents that were significantly influential regents. So I just called Nav Fawcett up one day and I said, if you still mean what you said, I'll come.
Just like that.
And he said, you set the date and we'll be delighted to have you come. So there I was with one more move on my hands, and we went to Ohio State. Ohio State was a strange experience. I almost became president at Ohio State 6 months after I went there as vice president. because now Fawcett was offered a major position outside the academic world entirely. He was sorely tempted to take it. And really, I think he had virtually decided to take it. To the point where two or three of the top trustees of the Ohio State University had already come to me and said, it looks to us like Nav is going to take this this job, and we want you to know that we want you to take over if he leaves us. Here I was, hardly gotten unpacked in the vice president's office yet. But fortunately, or at least I think fortunately for me, Fawcett didn't, finally in the very final analysis, didn't take that other job. Decided he didn't want to leave the academic world and stayed. It was the May of that end of that first year I was at Ohio State that I had the tragic blow of my father and mother being killed simultaneously in an automobile accident when they were driving down to Columbus from Madison here to help me celebrate my 50th birthday. And I found myself spending my 50th birthday at their funeral. And it was, I suppose 2-3 months after their death that, and in my, just as my second year at Ohio State was well underway, that I began getting overtures from the University of Missouri Board of Regents, Board of Curators, they call them in Missouri, suggesting their interest in my coming to the University of Missouri as president. And those negotiations went on over a period of, 6 months. When I was finally, they finally offered me the position, I guess I felt that, I've sat in all the chairs, and the University of Missouri is a strong AAU university, and it's a real opportunity. The man who was retiring as president there, Elmer Ellis, had been a very good friend of mine over the years. Elmer Ellis was a distinguished historian and president of the University of Missouri. He'd been dean of liberal arts at Missouri for, 20 years anyway, and then had been president for 12. He was a very good friend of mine, and even Elmer Ellis was trying to persuade me to take the region seriously down there. And so when that offer came along and the Board of Curators had me down, Roberta and me down to St. Louis and wined and dined us for 2 days and persuaded us of their 100% support of us for the president of the University of Missouri, we decided to go. Having gone that far on the ladder, they might just as well take a run at the last seat on the line. And so we went. Very interesting in a way for a Wisconsin boy, because one thing I always then and subsequently have had occasion to take a rather special interest in is the fact that the first president of the University of Missouri was John H. Lathrop.
Oh, yes.
Who, after 6 or 7 years as president of the University of Missouri, finally put all of his worldly belongings on a barge on the Mississippi River and came up to Prairie du Chien and Inman to Madison to be the first president of the University of Wisconsin. And I was the 14th president of the University of Missouri, and ultimately became the 15th president of the University of Wisconsin, which was a kind of an interesting succession of events over a period of 125 or so years. I think I had a successful career as president of the University of Missouri. I had plenty of problems, as any university president is going to. But I think things were going along well there. My relations with my board at Missouri were excellent. Continued to be right down to the day I left. They were very, very disappointed to have me go. They and I had developed a fine relationship. As I told them, and as is manifestly the truth, I don't think I think when I became president of the University of Missouri, I saw that as the end of this long trail of administrative life. I didn't really see myself ever moving from that to another position. And but as I told the curators at Missouri at the time it happened, I guess the only thing that I would have ever left the University of Missouri presidency for was the unusual request to return to my own university in Madison as president. University of Wisconsin has not been known for making alumni presidents. I think the only, I think maybe Van Hise had an undergraduate and graduate degree from Wisconsin. Connie Elvium, I believe, had only his graduate degree from here, if I remember correctly. I think, and I think aside from Van Hise and Elvium, I'm the only one who ever became president of this university who was a born and bred alumnus of the institution, from top to bottom. That was just something I couldn't decline to do. When you're invited home, you go home. And I had influential observers of the American higher educational scene all over the United States who said to me at the time I agreed to come back here, John, for goodness sake, you wouldn't do that. That's a foolish thing to do. Wisconsin and the utter turmoil it was in at the time, the building, you know, had just been blown up.
The Sterling Hall incident.
The Sterling Hall had been blown up just 2 months before they asked me to come back as president. And you know the turmoil this university was in at the time. But my feeling, and what as I said to many friends at the time, the fact that your university is in trouble is all the more reason you would go to help if you thought there was anything you could do to help, or they thought there was anything you could do to help, perhaps even more so than if it weren't in trouble. So I elected to come. And I guess that I've now strung out the long story almost a lot farther than you wanted me to, but it's a matter of the University of Wisconsin. There were, I guess, several reasons that perhaps it my experience and the opportunity here came together in a sort of fortuitous way. The University of Missouri, like the University of Wisconsin at the time, was a multi-campus university.
This was your first experience, was it not, with a multi-campus situation?
Well, no, you see, the University of Missouri had four campuses.
No, I mean Missouri.
Yes, Missouri was. That's right. And I had spent 4 or 5 years there at Missouri trying to preside over the sometimes competing, sometimes cooperating, sometimes cold, sometimes warm relations between a collection of campuses. And it was comparable in size to what Madison then was in terms of Madison had Parkside, Green Bay, Milwaukee, Madison, and statewide extension, and some centers. Missouri consisted of Columbia, two urban universities, one in St. Louis and one in Kansas City, and the specialized university, engineering and physical science university at Rolla, and the statewide extension. So I had some very real experience in the management of that kind of a multi-campus operation. And of course, as you note, my whole life has been public higher education and the public comprehensive university from Minnesota to Ohio State and Missouri. And but of course there was this special quality of coming home, and I elected to do so, even though at the time we came the university was in great turmoil, and as you may well remember, turmoil to the point where I was not allowed to speak to my first faculty meeting over here in the Humanities Building. All the Vietnam protesters jammed the meeting, maybe 500 of them, and yelled and hooted and demanded that I talk about Vietnam, and as I indicated, Vietnam was not what I came to Wisconsin to work with. So because I wouldn't talk about Vietnam, they broke up the meeting, and
as I recall, it disbanded without proceeding.
So it just disbanded. I can remember very well when I'd been here for about a week, a group of the student dissidents, leadership of the student dissidents, decided to find out what kind of a person this new president was, and came to my Van Hise office. A big mob of them filled the outer office, demanding to see me and demanding to deliver some demands to me. And I said, well, I'll see 10 of them. If they want to select 10 as the representatives of the group, I'll talk to 10 of them, and I won't try to converse with them off. And they finally elected 10 of their group, or chose 10 of their group to come into my conference room. And things were so tight and so nervous in those days that the campus security people were urging me not to see them at all, because they thought it was dangerous. And my attitude was, well, if life has come to the point where it's so dangerous that you can't talk to a group of students, better that I find it out now. But I can remember very well when that group came into that conference room and they sat down and they started reading this list of demands to me about this, that, and the other thing that I had to do. And when they got through, I just said, now look, said, if you, I said, you need to know that I came home to the University of Wisconsin because I happen to love the place. Now, if you want to hand wrestle me for it, that's what I'm ready to do. But you aren't going to close this university up in the name of freedom. And I guess it was about 4 or 5 days later that we had the entire Wisconsin State Highway Patrol arrayed in battle regalia across the front of the Bascom Hill to make it clear that we meant what we said. And those were tense and very difficult and disturbing days. But fortunately, by the end of that first spring that I was here, the Vietnam War had begun to spiral down. The draft was coming off. In my view, a very large proportion of the student rebellion was not so much the beautiful idealism that so many people wanted to paint it as it was a response to the pressures of the draft of an unpopular war. And once the pressure of the draft began to be lifted, things subsided fairly quickly.
That, I think, is my impression.
And so that by the middle of that summer of 71, I'd say the rebellion was essentially over. Thank heaven.
Hadn't there been something of this at Missouri before you came here?
Yes, indeed. We had our mass meetings and our demonstrations and our carrying on down at Columbia, but it never really achieved quite the heat of the rebellion here at Wisconsin. It was disturbing. We had the state patrol on the campus at Columbia a number of times. I came to have the reputation for being a hard hat, one who retaliated with force rather quickly, but I don't apologize for that, because as I was saying a moment ago, there is no freer place. There is no place where freedom is more revered or more carefully protected than in a university, in the American tradition of an American university. And to try by force and mob rule in the name of freedom, to try to close a university, was such a thing that I couldn't live with in my own conscience, to the point where I was prepared to use whatever force necessary to keep a university open. Because if that kind of mob behavior could close a university and rob the majority of the university community of freedom, we had a kind of anarchy I wasn't prepared to accept.
Oh, this is a supposed question, I guess. Supposing the attitude on the campus had not somewhat subsided, would you have continued to call on the National Guard or the State Patrol?
If necessary to keep the university open and functioning, yes. I would have regretted doing it every time I did it, because I don't think those kind of forces are appropriate in a university either. But if the forces of rebellion and repression are such that the only way you can keep the freedoms of a university alive, I'd use the force necessary to do it. I think the end justified the means. Certainly I wanted no tragedies like Kent State, but on the other hand, undisciplined society is going to lead itself to trouble of a violent sort. And I guess I believe that ultimately law, order, and freedom have to be paid for in a responsible way. And well, I just never could accept the notion that the student rebellion was an acceptable manifestation of free speech. It was an effort to destroy freedom, really.
Of course they didn't see it this way.
Of course not. But I think the university had to take a very strong position to protect itself. A university community, a university mechanism is terribly vulnerable to force because it doesn't have any of the traditions built within its fiber to resist force with force. That just isn't the way of life of a university. But it was our very vulnerability that it seemed to me called on us to muster the discipline and force necessary to protect the life of the institution itself. But those were very difficult and harassing days, and fortunately they're behind us, and I hope they stay behind us.
Just one detail in regard to that. I'm curious about how much of the decision making in regard to these disruptions was made by you and how much you sort of delegated to Chancellor Young.
Well, Chancellor Young and I were, of course, in close contact in the days of the days of highest tensions, and were in agreement on what we were doing. He was the one who really was the field marshal in charge of operations. But when the State Highway Patrol was arrayed across the front of Bascom Hall in battle regalia, elbow to elbow, to protect Bascom Hall, they were there at Ed Young's invitation, and they were there under the conditions that he prescribed, although he and I were in agreement on what he was doing. He knew I would back him up. But all that is sort of background and prelude to what I guess is a major chapter of what you want to discuss, namely the fact that I had non-negotiable demands from the students, but I also had a non-negotiable demand the day I walked in my office practically for the first time from the governor, whose non-negotiable demand was merger.
Yes.
And that, I guess, probably is a subject of sufficient length, that since you said 2 hours was a reasonable length for one of these, maybe we'd better make that the starting point for the second 2 hours. Perhaps we moved oftener than we would have chosen in the abstract to do, but every one of the experiences we had has been a pleasant one. It always was a case of leaving with regret and with people around us seeming to be sorry to see us go. It was a sort of a succession of the call of new adventure and new undertaking that led us from one stage of the of my career to the next. I can't remember there ever having been any rancor associated with any place we left or any feeling of wanting to leave because somebody wanted us to leave. And I never remember having moved to a place that didn't in itself seem to present a new challenge that was sort of an opportunity that you just didn't want to miss. And I guess that while I've spent 22 years in full-time administration, in all those successions of positions, there really never was a time in that whole succession of events when I really felt that I was pointing toward trying to get to something. I think we were simply taking life as it came. And somehow you got on the escalator and it kept moving. And there never seemed to be a convenient or compelling place to step off the escalator. And but there never was a time in those 22 years when I didn't live with the basic feeling in the back of my mind that anytime anybody would like me just to go back to teaching, I'm ready.
I noticed that you were listed in several of these institutions as Professor of Geography.
I was Professor of Geography at all of those institutions. And I was acceptable in the faculty, and I was prepared, willing, and ready to give up the trials of administration and return to teaching anywhere along the line, just as I am right now.
Well, now I know that you did, you have done some teaching here. Did you ever do any teaching at these other places?
Some. I never did get a chance to do any teaching in Kansas. I taught once or twice in the geography department at Nebraska. I taught once at Iowa. I guess I didn't ever have a chance to do any teaching at Ohio State or at Missouri. But since I've gotten back here to Wisconsin, I've taught twice in the geography department and three times in the that science and man program where mature members of the faculty take on 20 students on whatever subject the professor would like to teach, and I taught photography three times in that program for a semester. That's been important to me for a number of reasons. I have wanted to keep some regular touch in the best ways I could with students. Because it's so easy to get into these administrative, full-time administrative positions and lose all contact with what the real purpose of the whole thing's all about, namely the students. Roberta and I have tried very hard in all the years we've been here at Wisconsin, as we have at the other institutions where we've been, to find various excuses to have students in the house, have students around us. In informal kinds of situations where you really hear them talking about what's really on their minds.
And what kind of events?
Well, I've always been very interested in college baseball. I'm one of the few people that shows up at the college baseball games. Partly because I just like baseball, partly because Danny Mansfield taught me long ago to be interested in college baseball here in Wisconsin. But just as one kind of contact, in the years we've been here at Wisconsin, we've had Tom Meyer and the Wisconsin baseball team and their dates over the house for supper at the end of the baseball season. That brought 75 or 80 young people into the house. We've, every year since we've been here at Wisconsin, we've had a party in the spring for the Wisconsin Singers, the cheerleaders, and the pom-pom girls. Wonderful kids. Just a randomly selected bunch of students from fields all over the university, and just very fine young people. You see, we would see the cheerleaders during the football season. We'd see the singers in their concerts as we were out on alumni events, and I always gave the pom-pom girls flowers at homecoming, and so we'd get them all together and have a big party at the house in the spring. We didn't have any events at the house that I enjoyed more than most. When I was teaching my photography class, we always had the last meeting of the class at the house for dinner. And that gave me a chance to talk with the students in a more informal way than I'd had a chance to in the classroom. We just tried to pick various kinds of student groups and just set up the opportunity for being with them so that you could get acquainted. And I'm very pleased with the fact that even as president of this system, which is so vast and so big, I can't walk across this campus from one side to the other without having had a dozen students walking along the sidewalk speak to me, because they know me. And I think that's important. Because the thing isn't so big that the president shouldn't be recognized by, or feel that the students know well enough to feel free to stop and talk to when they see him. And I think a president who loses contact with the students because his job is so lofty and so distant has made a serious error. So as I say, we both, Roberta and I, have tried very hard to set up those kinds of opportunities where we get acquainted with the young people. Every fall I've go out to see the football team a couple of times, and John Giardino is frequently always rounds them up somewhere during practice and lets me talk to them a little while. And I've followed the hockey team, and I can remember one time as we were at a formal party down that was being given downtown, and the night Wisconsin won the championship and the right to go to the national hockey finals down at Notre Dame, they flew home. It was raining that night, and Elroy Hirsch and I were both in tuxedos that night, standing out in the rain to welcome the hockey team home when they came back from South Bend. I don't mention those things. At least once a fall, I'd go out to the airport and shake hands with each member of the football team as they got on the airplane going to some game somewhere. It wasn't for me, this was not a matter of trying to do what a university president is supposed to do in terms of looking like mm-hmm. he supports athletic teams or something. To me, the importance of that was personal contact with live students in various contexts and in various circumstances, and I found it always rewarding. I like young people. I suppose that's why I like to be a teacher.
Could be.